Test 1. Task 1. Read carefully through the instructions and questions for Task 1.1. You have 3 minutes for this before the recording begins.
Hello and welcome to the programme. We're looking at the business of education today. What? I hear you say education isn't a business. Well, in fact, there are quite a few people treating it as though it is. Not just a business, but a global one at that. We'll ask whether it works. And we have guests managing educational services. We'll spend a few minutes with each to hear what they're up to. And first up is James Tooley, who's chairman of a company called Omega Schools, operating private schools. And James, these are in Ghana in particular.
Yes, Ghana. We're also moving into Sierra Leone and probably across other parts of West Africa.
So yes. Tell us how it started.
I'm a professor at Newcastle University, and I've been doing research about low-cost private schools for a decade. These are schools in the slums in poor areas of Africa and Asia. And when I first, as it were, discovered these schools for myself, I immediately saw, yes, they're better than the government schools that the poor families are not sending their children to, but of course they can be improved. And one way of doing that would be to create a chain of these schools. So we have a chain of schools, we can raise investment, we can invest in R&D, we can get economies of scale. And so that's what, just about 4 years ago, the Ghanaian business partner, Ken Donko, I started Omega Schools. It's grown to about 20 schools in 3 years. We're building 20 more now. We'll grow to about 300 schools in the next 5 to 7 years. Right.
Well, take us through the customer experience of these schools, if we can use that phrase. How much does it cost?
They cost about 30 to 40p per day, but that includes lunch, uniform, books. Parents pay daily. and that covers everything. There's no hidden costs. It's based on the, if you like, the cash flow of the poor is daily. The parents are market traders, they're fishermen, farmers, daily paid labourers. They get money daily, so we ask for a fee daily. And parents tell us that the other low-cost private schools, they would charge on a termly basis. You've got to save up maybe £10, £15 a term, and then you've got to find other costs like uniform, books, PTA fees and so on. It's rather like a primary school that you and I might have known years ago, except we've got a computer lab. Our teachers have all got lesson plans. We've all got pupil workbooks that link in with the lesson plans.
And we should say this is a for-profit model. It's a real company. It aims to make some money. Is it making money?
Yeah, it's a for-profit model. It's certainly broken even, and we've raised considerable investment in order to expand further. All the profits are being reinvested currently. You know, we're in that expansion phase where everything is being reinvested.
All right, thanks for explaining that, James. Also with us is Carl Ligo, who's chief executive of BPP, which runs a large private university in the UK, as well as other higher and professional education around the world. But, Carl, you tell us about BPP, because I think of it as being vocational, postgraduate degrees, law and accountancy and the like.
Yeah, it's very niche. We educate about a third of all lawyers that qualify in England and Wales and about two-thirds of all accountants. And we've got something like 140,000 students worldwide. And we started off as a specialist publishing company, publishing learning materials using new word processing technology. And we sell those study kits in something like 186 countries around the world. And we team up with the professional bodies and work with them to create programs that are more sort of work relevant. And it's something that I hear as I go around the world, that people want more work-relevant, vocational-relevant education. And we've certainly worked in that sort of arena. And the company BPP was listed on the London Stock Exchange.
It's for profit. Does it make a profit?
Of course, yeah.
Who do you see as your competition? In England and Wales, for example, who do you see as the competition?
There are some universities, and they tend to be the newer universities that have operated in this vocational sector. But to be honest with you, there's not a great deal of competition here. Getting close to the employer has probably been the remit of one or two small private companies that have grown.
And who pays for the students who come? The students pay themselves, I know, but do they get loans? Are they in the state loan system?
Essentially two-thirds of our students are sponsored by their employer. We do have a small undergraduate school that has access to the student loan scheme, so we've got a thriving undergraduate provision. But to be honest with you, most of this is paid for by employers.
Let's talk more generally about the business of education. And maybe we should just start on a point where I think many listeners would be, on whether it should be a business at all.
Well, I joined BPP from a public university. A public university that was under-resourced, underfunded, did not specialise, was not offering the best service it possibly could to the profession that I practised. And so I joined a private company that had those resources available to better make the needs of clients. And the fact that we have a third of the entire legal profession studying with us is testament to the fact that better resources can be put in, that you can do things. And you've got to look at what is the purpose of the business. If the business is there solely to make money, it's a bad business. If it's there about improving the educational experience, then of course, why should it matter whether it's my taxpayer money that's paying for it or the private employer's money that's paying for it? And by 2025, the world population will have increased by 1 billion. Do you know how many universities on Howard's traditional model we would need to create every week to satisfy that population demand? It's four new universities that have to open it every week. That's impossible. Yeah. It's impossible for the state to be able to create that. So you do need private capital to help.
A privately funded education sector. Why do the public at least have this view that education is very different to everything else?
It's bizarre because...
I don't think it is. I'll tell you why I think they do. And they may be right, they may be wrong. I won't prejudge. But I think it's to do with the feeling that there should be something more egalitarian about education. That the delivery should be though to those who can make best use of it.
Yeah.
Or who need it, rather than to those who have the money to pay for it. And that is why the public have a different view of health and education from baked beans and motor cars.
So I think we were answering that question tangentially. I think we all agree with that basic, that there should be opportunities for all, whether you're poor or rich. And then you've got to look at the reality on the ground. Can governments, or do governments, in different parts of the world deliver good opportunities for the poor as well as the rich, and it's patently not the case. Governments do not deliver that in the countries in which I'm working, at least, and therefore there's clearly a space for the private sector to step in. And for my work, it's quite extraordinary. The private sector has already stepped in. There has been this grassroots privatisation in poor parts of Africa, for instance. And it's because poor parents say government is not succeeding in delivering what we require.
Moving on from the, I suppose, what you might call the ethics of running a business in education, there are other special features of that whole sector, aren't there? One that occurs to me is the degree to which a reputation is important. It's all about reputation, isn't it?
The school level reputation is almost everything as well.
How did you create it? How did you get the business in the first place?
My area is probably very idiosyncratic and very different from my colleagues here. But the brand, if you're serving the poor, the reputation there, you first of all create the school, you create the teaching materials, you train the teachers, you do all those things, and the reputation gets fed by word of mouth. I mean, we didn't even have any signs on our schools. We certainly didn't spend any money on logos or advertising or anything like that. It was all about word of mouth amongst poor parents saying, Omega Schools, they are delivering something better than any alternative now.
It's addressing an unmet need. If public universities were so good, then private companies wouldn't exist. You know, that's the truth of it. So if I look at BPP, we've got very close to clients. We've understood precisely what it is that is not being provided by the university sector and moved in. If I use my own experience as a practicing barrister, the first time that ever I got up on my feet in a courtroom to represent a client was when I was representing two defendants in real life. Now, that's shocking. It is shocking that a barrister...
That was because the traditional university did not give good teaching, practical teaching.
Well, it was an academic course. It was not practical. It wasn't preparing me for the world of work. Now, my students in my law school will go through at least 8 or 9 different trials. They will give opening speech, closing speeches. They will have opponents.
Hello and welcome to the programme. We're looking at the business of education today. What? I hear you say education isn't a business. Well, in fact, there are quite a few people treating it as though it is. Not just a business, but a global one at that. We'll ask whether it works. And we have guests managing educational services. We'll spend a few minutes with each to hear what they're up to. And first up is James Tooley, who's chairman of a company called Omega Schools, operating private schools. And James, these are in Ghana in particular.
Yes, Ghana. We're also moving into Sierra Leone and probably across other parts of West Africa.
So yes. Tell us how it started.
I'm a professor at Newcastle University, and I've been doing research about low-cost private schools for a decade. These are schools in the slums in poor areas of Africa and Asia. And when I first, as it were, discovered these schools for myself, I immediately saw, yes, they're better than the government schools that the poor families are not sending their children to, but of course they can be improved. And one way of doing that would be to create a chain of these schools. So we have a chain of schools, we can raise investment, we can invest in R&D, we can get economies of scale. And so that's what, just about 4 years ago, with a Ghanaian business partner, Ken Donko, I started Omega Schools. It's grown to about 20 schools in 3 years. We're building 20 more now. We'll grow to about 300 schools in the next 5 to 7 years.
Right. Well, take us through the customer experience of these schools, if we can use that phrase. How much does it cost?
They cost about 30 to 40p per day, but that includes lunch, uniform, books. Parents pay daily, and that covers everything. There's no hidden costs. It's based on the, if you like, the cash flow of the poor is daily. The parents are market traders, they're fishermen, farmers, daily paid labourers. They get money daily, so we ask for a fee daily. And parents tell us that the other low-cost private schools, they would charge on a termly basis. You've got to save up maybe £10-15 a term, and then you've got to find other costs like uniform, books, PTA fees and so on. It's rather like a primary school that you and I might have known years ago, except we've got a computer lab. Our teachers have all got lesson plans. We've all got pupil workbooks that link in with the lesson plans.
And we should say this is a for-profit model. It's a real company. It aims to make some money. Is it making money?
Yeah, it's a for-profit model. It's certainly broken even, and we've raised considerable investment in order to expand further. All the profits are being reinvested currently. You know, we're in that expansion phase where everything is being reinvested.
All right, thanks for explaining that, James. Also with us is Carl Ligo, who's chief executive of BPP, which runs a large private university in the UK, as well as other higher and professional education around the world. But, Carl, you tell us about BPP, because I think of it as being vocational, postgraduate degrees, law and accountancy and the like.
Yeah, it's very niche. We educate about a third of all lawyers that qualify in England and Wales, and about two-thirds of all accountants. And we've got something like 140,000 students worldwide. And we started off as a specialist publishing company, publishing learning materials using new word processing technology. And we sell those study kits in something like 186 countries around the world. And we team up with the professional bodies and work with them to create programs that are more sort of work relevant. And it's something that I hear as I go around the world, that people want more work-relevant, vocational-relevant education. And we've certainly worked in that sort of arena. And the company, BPP, was listed on the London Stock Exchange.
For-profit?
Yeah, it's for-profit.
Yep. Does it make a profit?
Of course, yeah.
Who do you see as your competition? In England and Wales, for example, who do you see as the competition?
There are some universities, and they tend to be the newer universities that have operated in this vocational sector. But to be honest with you, there's not a great deal of competition here. Getting close to the employer has probably been the remit of one or two small private companies that have grown.
And who pays for the students who come? The students pay themselves, I know, but do they get loans? Are they in the state loan system?
I mean, essentially two-thirds of our students are sponsored by their employer. We do have a small undergraduate school that has access to the student loan scheme, so we've got a thriving undergraduate provision. But to be honest with you, most of this is paid for by employers.
Let's talk more generally about the business of education. And maybe we should just start on a point where I think many listeners would be, on whether it should be a business at all.
Well, I joined BPP from a public university. A public university that was under-resourced, underfunded, did not specialise, was not offering the best service it possibly could to the profession that I practised. And so I joined a private company that had those resources available to better make the needs of clients. And the fact that we have a third of the entire legal profession studying with us is testament to the fact that better resources can be put in, that you can do things. And you've got to look at what is the purpose of the business. If the business is there solely to make money, it's a bad business. If it's there about improving the educational experience, then of course, why should it matter whether it's my taxpayer money that's paying for it or the private employer's money that's paying for it? And by 2025, the world population will have increased by 1 billion. Do you know how many universities on Howard's traditional model we would need to create every week to satisfy that population demand? It's four new universities that have to open it every week. That's impossible. Yeah. It's impossible for the state to be able to create that. So you do need private capital to help.
A privately funded education sector. Why do the public at least have this view that education is very different to everything else?
It's bizarre because...
Well, I don't think it is. I'll tell you why I think they do. And they may be right, they may be wrong. I won't prejudge. But I think it's to do with the feeling that there should be something more egalitarian about education. That the delivery should be though to those who can make best use of it.
Yeah.
Or who need it, rather than to those who have the money to pay for it. And that is why the public have a different view of health and education from baked beans and motor cars.
So I think we were answering that question tangentially. I think we all agree with that basic, that there should be opportunities for all, whether you're poor or rich. And then you've got to look at the reality on the ground. Can governments, or do governments in different parts of the world, deliver good opportunities for the poor as well as the rich? And it's patently not the case. Governments do not deliver that in the countries in which I'm working, at least. And therefore, there's clearly a space for the private sector to step in. And for my work, it's quite extraordinary. The private sector has already stepped in. There has been this grassroots privatisation in poor parts of Africa, for instance. And it's because poor parents say government is not succeeding in delivering what we require.
Moving on from the, I suppose, what you might call the ethics of running a business in education, there are other special features of that whole sector, aren't there? One that occurs to me is the degree to which a reputation is important. It's a It's all about reputation, isn't it?
The school level reputation is almost everything as well.
How did you create it? How did you get the business in the first place?
My area is probably very idiosyncratic and very different from my colleagues here. But the brand, if you're serving the poor, the reputation there, you first of all create the school, you create the teaching materials, you train the teachers, you do all those things. And the reputation gets fed by word of mouth. I mean, we didn't even have any signs on our schools. We certainly didn't spend any money on logos or advertising or anything like that. It was all about word of mouth amongst poor parents saying, Omega Schools, they are delivering something better than any alternative now.
It's addressing an unmet need. If public universities were so good, then private companies wouldn't exist. You know, that's the truth of it. So if I look at BPP, we've got very close to clients. We've understood precisely what it is that is not being provided by the university sector and moved in. If I use my own experience as a practicing barrister, the first time that ever I got up on my feet in a courtroom to represent a client was when I was representing two defendants in real life. Now, that's shocking. It is shocking that a barrister...
That was because the traditional university did not give good teaching, practical teaching.
Well, it was an academic course. It was not practical. It wasn't preparing me for the world of work. Now, my students in my law school will go through at least 8 or 9 different trials. They will give opening speech, closing speeches. They will have opponents.
Now answer the questions. You have 2 minutes to complete this task. Test 1. Task 2. Read carefully through the instructions and questions for task 1.2. You have 2 minutes for this before the recording begins.
winning. Isn't it great? When we watch dancing, singing, light entertainment, nowadays we watch people trying to win competitions for dancing, singing, being lightly entertaining. So those competing don't even have to be dancers or singers or entertainers, which is odd, because the chance of winning, the presence of competition, is supposed to create excellence. And yet, it pretty much enforces mediocrity. Watching an amateur learn how to do something is naturally heartwarming, but seeing someone professional do something amazingly, that exalts the soul. Our law courts run on an adversarial system. Our idea of justice favours a tussle for victory between prosecution and defence, rather than panels of trained judges sifting evidence and cooperating to find the truth. Actually, in the UK, we hold over 90% of criminal trials in front of panels of magistrates, but the drama of people in wigs trying to outfox each other enchants us. It's about winning. This may be why we pay limited attention to the qualifications of our magistrates. They're volunteers, mostly white, and have no formal legal training. Some are wonderful, insightful, and heed their professional legal advisers. Others, not so much. Our fixation on winning has helped produce a huge blind spot in our administration of justice. And lack of funding for policing, forensics, legal aid, the Crown Prosecution Service and the overloaded court system makes a troubling situation worse. Of course, bank bailouts and a massive recession brought on by market instability have helped precipitate funding cuts. But what is our stock market? A casino that charges punters to help them win. What motivates traders and investors? Winning. The city touts big wins, fast wins, artificial products created to promise high returns. A few fines and wrist slaps aside, the public purse shoulders the expense of clearing up the financial community's messes. Again, the pursuit of winning seems to encourage mediocrity and failure. But what about our parliamentary system? Westminster insists on winner takes all, even if the winner only wins by a tiny majority. Parliamentarians long for wins that let their party gain a crushing majority so they never need compromise pure ideology. And I'm not even going to say how that's turning out for us all, because it's early in the year and I like to ration the despair I experience in any given month. Westminster's pursuit of winning, its love of team loyalty, frustrates people who got into politics to serve the public and observers who like to think of democracy as a good thing. The pursuit of victory over principle means we have still unfolding scandals about illegal campaign funding, dark money political funding, and the use of public money to influence votes or preserve majorities. And when we follow the trails of dark money across the Atlantic, we see secretive funding of new media, intervention by foreign powers, voter purging, gerrymandering, and catalogued interference with voting machines. Winning at any price seems to be suffocating democracy. Back in the UK, as households worry about the future and need benefits to supplement low wages or zero-hour contracts, the betting industry takes advantage of the fact that desperate people are statistically more likely to take risks. Deregulation of the betting industry means bookmakers can consistently reinforce the dream that anyone can and should be a winner. But the house always wins. And now I have to mention that I'm old enough, although you wouldn't be able to tell by looking. Winning. Isn't it great? When we watch dancing, singing, light entertainment, nowadays we watch people trying to win competitions for dancing, singing, being lightly entertaining. So those competing don't even have to be dancers or singers or entertainers, which is odd, because the chance of winning, the presence of competition, is supposed to create excellence. And yet, it pretty much enforces mediocrity. Watching an amateur learn how to do something is naturally heartwarming, but seeing someone professional do something amazingly, that exalts the soul. our law courts run on an adversarial system. Our idea of justice favours a tussle for victory between prosecution and defence, rather than panels of trained judges sifting evidence and cooperating to find the truth. Actually, in the UK, we hold over 90% of criminal trials in front of panels of magistrates, but the drama of people in wigs trying to outfox each other enchants us. It's about winning. This may be why we pay limited attention to the qualifications of our magistrates. They're volunteers, mostly white, and have no formal legal training. Some are wonderful, insightful, and heed their professional legal advisers. Others, not so much. Our fixation on winning has helped produce a huge blind spot in our administration of justice. And lack of funding for policing, forensics, legal aid, the Crown Prosecution Service and the overloaded court system makes a troubling situation worse. Of course, bank bailouts and a massive recession brought on by market instability have helped precipitate funding cuts. But what is our stock market? A casino that charges punters to help them win. What motivates traders and investors? Winning. The city touts big wins, fast wins, artificial products created to promise high returns. A few fines and wrist slaps aside, the public purse shoulders the expense of clearing up the financial community's messes. Again, the pursuit of winning seems to encourage mediocrity and failure. But what about our parliamentary system? Westminster insists on winner takes all, even if the winner only wins by a tiny majority. Parliamentarians long for wins that let their party gain a crushing majority so they never need compromise pure ideology. And I'm not even going to say how that's turning out for us, or because it's early in the year and I like to ration the despair I experience in any given month. Westminster's pursuit of winning, its love of team loyalty, frustrates people who got into politics to serve the public and observers who like to think of democracy as a good thing. The pursuit of victory over principle means we have still unfolding scandals about illegal campaign funding, dark money political funding, and the use of public money to influence votes or preserve majorities. And when we follow the trails of dark money across the Atlantic, we see secretive funding of new media, intervention by foreign powers, voter purging, gerrymandering, and catalogued interference with voting machines. Winning at any price seems to be suffocating democracy. Back in the UK, as households worry about the future and need benefits to supplement low wages or zero-hour contracts, the betting industry takes advantage of the fact that desperate people are statistically more likely to take risks. Deregulation of the betting industry means bookmakers can consistently reinforce the dream that anyone can and should be a winner. But the house always wins. And now I have to mention that I'm old enough, although you wouldn't be able to tell by looking.
Now answer the questions. You have 2 minutes to complete this task. You should now move on to complete the remaining parts of the test.